Focus on the Family was founded by psychologist James Dobson in 1977. Since then, it's grown into one of the largest conservative Christian lobby groups in the United States, embracing magazines, radio, and television outlets. Visiting Australia this week is Tim Gagline, the Vice President for External Relations of Focus on the Family. He's a former Deputy Director of Public Liaison in the White House of George W. Bush, with a long career in Washington politics. Tim, welcome to Australia.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Tim, you've landed in Oz in the midst of an election campaign for our largest state, in which there are Christian groups, such as the Christian Democrats, standing for office. Will you be meeting their candidates?
You know, I'm going to be here for three very fulsome days. I will be doing interviews like this. I'll be talking with pastors. I will be going to your capital and meeting people there. This is really an opportunity, John, to come to Australia, which is my first visit, and to get a great sense of the land and to get a great sense of this interaction between the Ministry of Focus on the Family, which is family, marriage, and parenting. That's really our bullseye. How that does and does not connect with public policy, but above all, how it impacts families and the people of this great country. So the answer is that public policy is never far from the periphery. But yes, I will be interested in how these issues overlay with regard to the worldview that Focus on the Family discusses and makes the heart of our ministry.
You're one of those groups, or Focus on the Family is one of those groups that arose in the mid-1970s and a little later, which took Christianity out of the pulpit and put it back into the public sphere. What's the philosophy there?
I think this is something that is actually very little known and of great interest to all historians. But specifically, both political and religious or American religious historians, because until the presidency of Jimmy Carter in that very momentous year after Watergate and this new race between the vice president, the sitting vice president Gerald Ford, who succeeded Richard Nixon, of course, and Jimmy Carter, a very little known
peanut farmer.
Yes, a peanut farmer and governor of Georgia, also obviously a brilliant man.
And born-again evangelical.
A born-again evangelical, graduate of the Naval Academy, and on the campaign trail for the first time, John, used the phrase born-again Christian. David Broder of the Washington Post, one of the deans of American journalism, famously said to other colleagues, "What is a born-again Christian?" I mention all of this because, by and large, evangelical Christians had not been involved in politics. There was a great separatism tradition. There was a decoupling tradition. And until Jimmy Carter came into politics as an outspoken evangelical Christian, a man who was willing to use phrases like born-again Christian on the campaign trail, a man who said he was a praying man, a man who really connected for the first time with this very large subset of Americans who, by and large, had self-segregated themselves from politics, and it was Jimmy Carter's presidency, by and large, en masse, that brought evangelical Christians into the political sphere. Now, there was a bit of a jujitsu, which is that within 2 years, there was a lot of disillusion among the very evangelicals who had supported Jimmy Carter, by and large, because in the American context, he was more liberal on social policies than they were, and the American economy was not getting better. In fact, it was going completely in the wrong direction. And so by the time Ronald Reagan ran against Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan was not an evangelical Christian. He was a Christian. He also spoke about the importance of prayer in his life, etc. But he very famously, John, said at a very large convention of evangelicals, Ronald Reagan said, "You can't endorse me, but I endorse you." And this was a dramatic turning point for the very people you're speaking of in the mid-1970s. Evangelicals who had come into the public square, began voting, were very concerned about the advent of the sexual revolution and the way that that was impacting their lives. They really dramatically switched their allegiance to Ronald Reagan. And thus was born what you're talking about, the rise of religious conservatism as a voting bloc in America.
There are some very interesting strands there, which I'd like to pick up a little later, but let's personalize it a little. And how did it all shape for you? What led you into political activism as a career?
If we were having this discussion 27 years ago, I'm 47 years of age, I'm quite certain I could have made a declarative statement that I had absolutely no intention of being involved in politics. Journalism was always the thing that I was interested in and where I was most comfortable. In the summer of 1985, completely on a whim, the friend of the wife of Dan Quayle, who was then a senator from my home state, a U.S. senator from my home state, Indiana, called me and said, would you ever consider being an intern in Washington, D.C. for the summer, an intern in the U.S. Senate for Dan Quayle? The idea intrigued me, and I said yes, and I spent 3 months there. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And the following summer, now I was a senior at Indiana University, I became an intern in the House of Representatives and an intern at NBC News on the weekends in Washington. And at that point, I really began to be fascinated by this relationship in America among public policy, politics, and the media. I graduated from Indiana University. I became a television producer. And as Providence would have it, Dan Coats, the little-known congressman I had been interning for 2 summers before, became a U.S. senator when Dan Quayle became vice president. And he called me and said, would you like to come back to Washington and be my deputy press secretary? And I worked for him the entire time he was in the Senate, which was 10 years. He retired. I thought I was retiring. And without boring you with the details, I went to work for the Bush-Cheney campaign and became very involved as a point man for all of American conservatives, but specifically for the faith-based community.
There's been an you've seen an extraordinary change over those 25, 30 years.
I would actually say, John, gigantic and tectonic shifts in American politics, yes. Yeah.
The election of Obama was very interesting in this because Obama went out of his way to court evangelicals. It had people on the evangelical left, if you like, that group that had mixed around Jimmy Carter, seemed to get its act together again through people like Ron Sider, Jim Wallace, Tony Campolo. And there was a strong evangelical support for Obama. So how do you see that playing out now, currently in the U.S.? What's the dynamics with the sort of evangelicals and politics?
As we say in the American English vernacular, you've asked the $64,000 question. You're right. This was a dramatic shift. In a way that John Kerry and in a way that Al Gore could not seem to master, which was the language, the ethos, the bathos, the way that you reach out to evangelical America. Barack Obama was intentional about this. Percentage-wise, he did not get a much larger percentage of American self-identified evangelical votes. It's not that his outreach didn't pay off in real numbers. There was a slight bump. But far beyond that, he attracted a particular group of people like the ones who you mentioned, who were reliable conduits. They were credible and are credible people who have great standing and who have been very intentional about looking at what has heretofore been a monolithic, by and large, group of American evangelical voting blocs and has said, how can we change that dynamic? Now we are more than 24 months into the Obama presidency, and the issues that American evangelicals care about most in public life, same-sex marriage, abortion on demand, the composition of our highest court, the Supreme Court, I would say by and large on those points, Barack Obama scores very low. And it stands to be seen what kind of an impact he will have in this current cycle, in this new campaign. But may I say that he has definitely scrambled the egg. He has done so in a way that is politically very important. And most importantly, it's a very wide open field on the Republican side. And because it is, it's not clear yet who American evangelicals will coalesce around or who they could coalesce around.
Yes, the reason I ask that is because it goes to one of the ways in which evangelical politics has manifested itself in the American scene, far more so explicitly than in the Australian scene, that a group has emerged which has said, look, we are normative for evangelicals. So if you're an evangelical, you support us. We are the Christian party. Now, the Obama thing changed that. It said, actually, no, you can no longer say this is the Christian standard, because other groups are saying, no, we're equally representing religious and evangelical views. We just simply happen to have a different set of political values. So the debate is now not so much about a Christian standard, but about where your politics sit.
You know, I find the points that you've made as an analysis exactly right. As a person who has worked very closely with one U.S. president and with one U.S. senator, both of whom were well-known evangelicals, where it was on our mind to be intentional about how we reach out, the question, or to use a cliche, you know, the proof is in the pudding, the question is how the scrambling of this egg will actually manifest itself in actual votes. Because in American politics, you can gather around a table like this and you can have an important discussion about the role of faith in public life, about mass attending Catholics and evangelicals and how they will or will not vote. And by the way, I've spent a lot of time with the millennial generation. This is a big part of what I do at Focus on the Family, this group of 18 to 29-year-olds and how they think about these questions. And we can maybe talk a bit about that, because I find this generation more pro-life than their parents and their grandparents, and more mixed on the question of marriage. But I say all of this because for all of the outreach on the part of Barack Obama and his White House, and I'm routinely in touch with the White House. I have excellent relationships there. And at Focus on the Family, we're not Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative. The heart of what we do is family, marriage, and parenting. That is the heart of our ministry. There may be people who disagree, and maybe even disagree very strongly with us, on our public policy division, even though it's called CitizenLink, even though I'm, you know, 100% in that camp. But the heart of our ministry is not how do you feel about same-sex marriage and how do you feel about et cetera, et cetera. It's really these fundamental questions of what constitutes strong families, the strong nuclear family, what constitutes parents who are in crisis, what constitutes orphan care and foster care and adoption and pro-life. And Focus on the Family is very central in its work in that regard. And that's where we spend the heart of our time and the heart of our money.
There are issues, though, which in the cracks will define things. I mean, you mention briefly there in passing the sort of where one sits on the issue about, let's take one, gay marriage, for example. For many years, there's been a consistent conservative position adopted by our politicians here in Australia of both sides. No, we will not recognise gay marriage. Others are now saying, well, that's fine, we can understand that marriage is a concept that comes out of religious tradition. What about gay civil unions? What about recognising that? And then others will say, to those who say, oh, no, the whole gay thing splits families and it breaks down the family structure. Well, no, actually, gay civil unions confirms the family structure. It actually says gays actually want this institution, which confirms things. So the lines are getting very blurred, aren't they?
You know, it's interesting. In the United States, we have had 31 state ballot or referendum initiatives on same-sex marriage. And in all 31, people of every geography, every political composition in the United States have chosen traditional marriage. In other words, when given an option to make homosexual marriage legal, they have each and every time said no. In six other states, and in the District of Columbia, where the people have not been asked their opinion, but where it's been court-imposed or commission-imposed, there has been success for homosexual marriage. So in the United States, by and large, when the people, or I'm sorry, in the United States categorically, when voters are asked their opinion in a ballot or referendum, they reject same-sex marriage, and they embrace traditional marriage. It's different with regard to civil unions. We do, in fact, have states with civil unions, and it's possible that that trajectory will increase. But I think I'm safe in saying, to this point, that even though President Obama himself, to go back to the point that you made earlier, even though President Obama himself has said that he and his Justice Department will no longer defend the Defense of Marriage Act, a bill that was signed and put into law by Bill Clinton, even though he has done that, he at the same time says that he does not favor same-sex marriage. So I'm not really saying these things to make a political point. I'm really saying them to make an observation, which is that by and large in the United States, Democrats and Republicans, self-identified liberals and conservatives, to this point, still categorically agree that same-sex marriage should not be legal in all 50 states. Because of the Defense of Marriage Act being argued in Massachusetts, because of what we call Proposition 8, another major debate going on in California, it's possible that this will go to the Supreme Court, and it's possible that either side could win. But as of today, I think it's fair to say that that's where the issue resides. And most importantly, it's where focus on the family resides. For this reason, we believe biblically that the best arrangement in the definition of family is one man and one woman living monogamously for a lifetime. That's what we believe the biblical standard is. We believe it's the best incubator for the raising of children. And we believe that every child deserves a mother and a father. Now, I say that at a time in America when 40% of all marriages end in divorce, 75% of all second marriages end in divorce, 40% of all Americans are born out of wedlock.
And the figures for Christians is no better than the figures for the rest of society.
It is fair to say that evangelical Christians, mass-attending Catholics, synagogue-attending Jews are largely enculturated to those same numbers. Mm. And I say this, John, because I'm not trying to put caveats here. The mandate for focus on the family will always be what is best for the nuclear family.
The interesting thing here, and it's a debate about the nature of civil society. Essentially, we're talking about politics. That is, how in a civil society, in which particularly in the United States, even more so than Australia, there is a separation between church and state, you can hold that set of values and fight for that set of values, yet at the same time, you are saying, look, we want the freedom to adopt this set of values for our community, but also we want to impose it on other communities who may disagree with us. So you're prepared to actually claim a right for yourself, but deny the same right of free association in forms they want to other groups. How do you get around that one?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, because it's just the opposite. Actually, in the United States, marriage has always been not sometimes, but categorically, a state issue. And so in the history of the United States, which is now over 239 years old, and from the beginning, states have always been the arbiter of marriage, never the federal government. So even the fact that we have a Defense of Marriage Act, when it was signed, was federalist in nature. In other words, it did not assume any power in Washington. It allowed states to be protected as they so chose. And the Proposition 8 battle that we're having in California, which is probably the most high-profile same-sex marriage battle, where the people of California chose, you know, to reject homosexual marriage. Even that, if it goes to the Supreme Court, will be decided, ultimately on a state-based question. So it's not really focus on the family or any other conservative Christian determining the rights or the non-rights of someone else. It's merely saying that this is what marriage has been in the United States from our founding, and this is what we defend.
Fascinating discussion goes on Sunday night. We're joined by Tim Gagline, Focus on the Family. He's in Australia for just a few days as Vice President for External Relations of Focus on the Family. He's a former Deputy Director of Public Liaison with the White House of George W. Bush. And joining us in the studio now is a representative of Focus on the Family in Australia. Neville Cox is Chair of the Australian Board of Focus on the Family. Neville's got a long career in Australian business. Neville, welcome to the discussion.
Thanks very much, John. It's great to be here.
Just tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be taking interest in Focus on the Family.
Well, my work career has been in banking and finance, And a few years ago, I was approached to get involved with Focus on the Family here in Australia, which I was pleased to do, I guess because my wife and I obviously had a great interest in our own family, but we also saw a lot of needs for families, and we thought that it was a great opportunity to get involved with somebody who was also wanting to see families thrive.
Now, you sort of speak quite modestly about your involvement in business in Australia, but you have been involved at a senior level in business in Australia.
Yes, I have. And I guess, John...
Just name us a couple of them.
Oh, well, I was on the executive committee of the Commonwealth Bank, and these days I chair the board of the AMP Bank. But one of the signs and encouraging signs was when I actually... left the Commonwealth Bank and had a wonderful retirement function. And on the way home, my youngest son said to me, "Well, Dad, you've done pretty well in your career, and you haven't mucked up your family in the process." And I kind of it just came home to me then, and it was reinforced. And I suppose it's one of the drivers for me today to say that you can have great success in life in some respects, but end up blowing it up in other respects if you don't retain your family.
You're, as well as being involved with Australian Focus on the Family, let's lay it out, and Tim, you might help us here too. The Focus on the Family has a global structure. And so where does the Australian chapter or board fit into the global structure?
Well, Australia is part of this particular region, the Australasian region, which at this stage takes in New Zealand, but also can participate in things in the Pacific area, any needs there and development there. And, of course, Focus on the Family in New Zealand has a lot of Pacific Island connections and people living there. So we are, in fact, doing some things in various parts of the Pacific Islands as well.
Now, Tim, you're here for 3 days. Yes. So are you here to basically help and support, and in what way?
Yeah, I'll tell you exactly. And to go back to the question that you asked, John, Focus on the Family is based in Colorado Springs, but we do have something called our Global Partnership. These are formal alliances, some of them larger, like the ones in Australia and in New Zealand, and some of them smaller. But the net effect is that Focus on the Family's broadcast, our flagship broadcast, is heard in 134 countries. It's heard by about 3 million people domestically in the United States, but it's heard by a little over 260 million people worldwide every week. We're the only faith-based program in China. In fact, we're opening a Beijing office, which is very exciting. And we are also heard on Armed Forces Network. So when it comes to the issues of family, marriage, and parenting, when it comes to marriages in crisis, parents who have several questions about children and what is the right thing to do, families who are experiencing crises of every kind imaginable, people who want to adopt, people who want to become foster parents, people who are looking for good counsel and good biblical advice, Focus on the Family is resource rich. And in regarding the question that you ask, the wonderful thing is whether you're in Australia or New Zealand or the United States or some other place, with two clicks of the mouse, you can tap into Focus on the Family and you can find a resource rich. And I think that's one of the strengths of Focus on the Family, a resource rich treasure trove of good advice, good counseling, books, this sort of thing.
Neville, what do you see as the main purpose of having Tim with you for these few days in Australia?
I think having anybody from Focus on the Family, the team at Focus on the Family in the US are really experts in their particular fields. And so this is a rare pleasure, in a sense, to have somebody of Tim's stature and coming from the sort of the nature of the work that he does to come here and engage with people here in Australia. And many of those people, in fact, would go and want to visit Tim in Washington, and some of them do.
Central to that is engagement with the political process. So you're aiming to hone your skills in that area?
Well, we're not really large enough to have all the facets of a Focus on the Family in the US, but certainly we draw on their resources when particular issues arise, because people come and ask us what our opinion is about things. And so we don't have the staffing resources to be able to handle everything. So having Tim, when it comes to public policy, I think in having Tim come here, I think one of the things that he's going to help us with is meet key individuals and talk to them about that relationship between faith and politics.
Well, you've got a New South Wales election coming up. How do you present yourselves in that context? Do you talk to politicians, or do you endorse particular groups?
No, we don't do that. But we basically talk to people about taking an interest in the political process, and in terms of what are some of the issues the top issues that they might like to think about, but not to be afraid to think about it and exercise your vote accordingly.
I might say in that regard as well, I speak, meet, and present for a living. And one of the things that I do, although I do not formally lobby, we have a public policy and governmental affairs division that's very involved in that area. I am in regular touch with senators, with congressmen, with think tanks, public policy groups. I'm on a different college campus about once every 7 or 8 weeks, sometimes more often. And I am asked every single time that I'm on a campus, I'm asked 50% of the time when I'm meeting with a congressman or senator, tell us about your international work. Where are you involved? What are the issues that you're working on there? What are you learning? I just spent 3.5 days in New Zealand, and I really absorbed it like a sponge, and I'm eager to do that in Australia as well. We've had a wonderful partnership, and I think it's very important that I'm obliged to say this. We do not have an office at Focus on the Family that gets up every morning, snaps on the lights, and says, that's what Australia will do today, that's what New Zealand will do tomorrow. It's just the opposite. It's very decentralized. We come alongside Focus Australia and vice versa, and we really work together for our common ministerial goals.
Well, what would be the ambitions for Focus on the Family, say, in the next, what's your five-year plan, Neville, for Australia?
Well, our plan for Australia is fundamentally about some of the things Tim's spoken about. It's really about continuing on in the process of helping to strengthen marriage and...
But doing that by engagement with the political process?
No, that's not how we do it. In fact, our engagement with the political process is where we do things that actually help meet the needs of specific groups of people in specific areas. And at times we've been requested by the government if we could run some of our programs in particular areas to help meet particular needs. But I think a classic example at the moment, for example, is that we are working with the broader community of Orange in New South Wales in terms of the issues affecting that particular area, in terms of relationships, in terms of drugs. And of course, Focus has very good, well-resourced programs that are academically based and really tried and tested. This is not about somebody's good idea. And so when we run a Drug Proof Your Kids program, you know that it's been well researched, well put together. And in fact, that particular program, which is used by the partnership of Focus in the Family, was actually developed here in Australia. And so working in that community of Orange, we're working with Indigenous leaders, we're working with councils and communities to basically help them address the needs in their community. Somebody just said to me recently that they'd spoken to a leader of local government in Queensland and said to them, what is the biggest issue that you're trying to address in your particular area? And expected them to come out with an economic story about something that they thought could be better economically. The answer was breakdown in relationships in our community. So that person was saying to me, what can Focus on the Family do to help come into that community, and with running its programs in schools or in community settings, what can it do to help?
As a large part of the discussion I've had with Tim related to the emergence of Christian conscience into politics over the last 30 years, where do you see that going in Australia? For example, a conscious Christian lobby emerged in the United States. Here in Australia, you have a group like the Australian Christian Lobby. Do you have sort of common aims, goals with a group such as that?
Yes, we do. But as I said earlier, we don't have the resources to specifically dedicate staff in that particular area. However, we will work alongside other organisations like the Australian Christian Lobby in terms of putting our viewpoint forward. In fact, in terms of providing resources or research that we can get hold of that might help in a particular case.
Neville Cox and Tim Gagelin, we've run out of time. It's been great to have you both with us.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for joining us here on ABC Radio on Sunday night.